case of Krautzinger versus the people, and we're ready to hear from the petitioner.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Zweibel. I represent the petitioner appellant in this matter, Charles Krautzinger. Also present are Dean Neuwirth and Gene Dubofsky, who also represent Mr. Krautzinger. Your Honors, no United States Supreme Court case has ever held that exclusion of defense evidence at trial must meet a constitutional materiality standard in order to be a constitutional violation. The case cited by Krautzinger 1 and Richmond, Valenzuela Bernal for that proposition, does not involve exclusion of trial evidence and does not set up such a standard in that situation. Valenzuela Bernal specifically concerned the competing obligations that the government faces when it is faced with deportation of illegal aliens who at the same time may be material witnesses in a criminal prosecution. And the materiality test was adopted to balance these competing interests. It was done after a thorough analysis of the government's obligations, both legal and practical, in the deportation arena. And it was specifically deemed appropriate to what the court called the government's exercise of manifold responsibilities. And if there remains any doubt that it was meant to apply only in that context, that doubt was eliminated by footnote 9 of the case. Quote, in adopting this standard, we express no opinion on the showing which a criminal defendant must make in order to obtain compulsory process for securing the attendance at his criminal trial of witnesses within the United States. So again, only for the deportation context. Valenzuela Bernal identified itself as being in the line of what it called access to evidence cases. Cases that involve the loss or suppression of evidence due to governmental action. Those cases, and what distinguishes those cases from trial exclusion cases, are that those cases involve choices that the government must make. The government has to make a choice. Shall we deport the witness or shall we hold the witness? The government has to make a choice. Which evidence of all the evidence we've collected in our investigation shall we disclose? Those are the access to evidence cases. And in that situation, a retrospective standard makes sense and is appropriate to help ensure that the government is not subject to undue second guessing of the choices that it makes. In contrast, the exclusion of trial evidence involves no such choices, no such governmental dilemmas. If evidence is admissible because it is relevant, meets evidentiary rules and standards, and the defendant has satisfied all of the procedural requirements that apply, then there is no governmental interest in erecting yet another barrier or yet another test called materiality that the defendant would have to meet.
Mr. Zweibel, if that's true, what's the test? For reversal.
I think it is.
Let's accept what you just said.
I'm sorry?
Let's accept your proposition. What's the test for reversal?
I think the test is relevancy, reliability.
No, I understand that. But then what happens? Okay.
Oh, then you proceed directly to
harmless error analysis. Straight harmless error.
The Constitution.
Why would you even? You mean every exclusion of relevant evidence is subject to constitutional harmless error analysis?
From the test perspective, it is, yes, because the reliability, all the governmental interests in gatekeeping are served by the evidentiary rules.
Let's step that for a second. I think that's inconsistent, it seems to me, with what Justice Souter says in Kyle's. Where he says the constitutional error analysis is the same thing as constitutional materiality analysis, basically.
Well, in that case, of course, they were dealing with materiality in the context of
Well, I understand that, but that's what he says, and he's talking about articulation of the standard. So I'm having trouble with your analysis.
Okay, and so let me back up just a minute so I can try to explain. The materiality test that Hiles was examining is the materiality test that applies in the Brady situation, where an access to evidence case, where the evidence is withheld or suppressed. And in that case, if there is a materiality standard, then that materiality standard would be equivalent to the ordinary harmless error standard. That's essentially what they say in Kyle's. Our argument is that that materiality standard does not apply in the first instance at all to the right to present a defense and the exclusion of trial evidence. That's a distinct situation. And so you don't have a materiality test, you don't do that analysis. Our argument also is that if you were to do that analysis, that materiality standard that was used in Kutzinger 1 and that was used in Richmond is the wrong standard. And so if there is a materiality standard to be had at all, it's certainly not the creation of a new reasonable doubt standard. Let's assume for a second that Valenzuela-Bernal can be applied to trial exclusion, although by its terms and by its explicit terms, it really can't be. But if it is, the standard that Valenzuela-Bernal adopted is in this sentence. Its holding is in this sentence. As in other cases concerning the loss of material evidence, sanctions will be warranted for deportation only if there is a reasonable likelihood that the testimony could have affected the judgment of the trier of fact. Begley identified that sentence as being the holding of Valenzuela-Bernal, and also stated, incidentally, that that standard is the equivalent of the constitutional harmless error analysis. So by a different route, we basically arrive, I think, at the same result. That's the holding of Valenzuela-Bernal. It does not hold, even in its own context, that materiality means creation of a new reasonable doubt. Excuse me, just a second. I apologize, I have a bit of a cold today, so I'm a little dry. Now, to go back to Justice Bender's question about the Begley standard and the Kyle standard, if we could somehow interpret Valenzuela-Bernal as having adopted the creation of a new reasonable doubt standard, as having said, well, we're basically going to adopt the harshest of the three Eggers standards. That standard was later superseded. That standard was superseded by Begley. Begley stated the three Eggers standards basically can be, are superseded and are no longer in effect because the standard now is a reasonable probability of a different result, which means a probability sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome. So to summarize just where I've gotten to so far, our primary argument is that there is no materiality standard. Our secondary argument is that if there is a materiality standard that can be derived from Valenzuela-Bernal, we have to look at the holding of Valenzuela-Bernal, and it is the could have affected, the reasonable likelihood that it could have affected the judgment of trier of fact.
Could you run down, assuming that we adopt both of your arguments for a minute about this material and constitutional materiality, run down how should we apply it in this case?
In this case, the case turns solely on the credibility of the complaining witness, SM. And all of the excluded evidence went to her credibility. And so frankly, I think under any test, the excluded evidence requires reversal. It's certainly not harmless beyond a reason.
Would that be a reversal by us or a remand for new hearing because the trial judge used the wrong test or what?
I think that that this court can apply the correct test and reverse. And that's what we're asking the court to do. And to be more specific, the Court of Appeals refused to reverse because it found that first of all, it applied the wrong test. And if the more lenient test is applied, obviously, we're looking at a different analysis. But applying that test, what it basically found is that the inconsistencies that were raised by Dr. Howard's excluded testimony were peripheral or somehow unimportant, didn't go to the core of the case. And that's clearly not true. And just as an example, we can look at the start date of the alleged abuse. Dr. Howard's notes indicated that SM told her that the abuse started when she was 4 or 5 years old. At trial, she said it was end of first, start of second grade. That's significant because it's not just some discrepancy in the date. It really casts into doubt the entire story that SM tells about the abuse. She says, it all happened when I was in elementary school. She says, it all happened when we were at the Bexley house. However, when she was 4 or 5, she was living in Houston, and she was not in elementary school. And so that's not peripheral. That goes to the entire context of the story. The same thing is true, for example, of the ending date of the alleged abuse. She says at trial that it's 6th grade. The notes say she says 4th grade at one time. And that casts into doubt another significant part of her story. She explains the end of the abuse by saying, in 6th grade, we moved to the Clareton house, and I had a lock on my bedroom door, and that's why it ended. But the 4th grade story casts into doubt that part of her version of events as well, so that the entire story really is thrown into doubt by these shifts in dates. Also, the notes would establish a motive for a false report, that she felt her mother didn't love her, that she disliked the defendant, that she didn't like her mother being with the defendant. And it was a motive, a means of requiring her mother to choose between herself and her and the defendant. Poor memory, she states, I had bad memory, my memory is not very good about events in elementary school, to Dr. Howard. All of these things, I think, really under any test would require reversal, but certainly under a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt test or an undermined confidence standard would require reversal.
Could I hold you right there just one second, since you said especially or under a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? You got up to the edge a few minutes ago, and then we took you someplace else, but assuming for purposes of argument, we go with you as far as constitutional materiality is not at issue here. We have trial error, and we have to decide what the standard for reversal is. Would you go a little further and explain to me why you think this is a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard rather than simply the harmless error standard?
Because if there is no materiality standard, and the evidence that was excluded was clearly relevant, it was clearly admissible. The only question about its admissibility had to do with whether it was privileged. And so having gotten beyond that, I think the way it can be explained is this. I think the trial court, has discretion to determine whether evidence is relevant. It has discretion in applying the rules of evidence. But once it's determined that evidence is relevant, once it's determined that evidence actually has met the standards for the rules of evidence for admissibility, I think the discretion ends. At that point, the Constitution, which guarantees the right to present a complete defense, requires admission. So at that point, any further exclusion of the evidence, once those determinations are made, is a constitutional.
I'm getting just a little confused about whether we're talking about whether error was committed at all and then talking about how we decide whether to reverse once error is committed. We got error here, and maybe I'm just not picking up on you, but where would you draw the line then about what constitutes error of constitutional magnitude and what constitutes simply trial error?
Well, I think that when the defense offers evidence, if it meets the evidentiary standards of relevancy, if it meets the evidentiary standards of reliability, if it meets procedural requirements, once we get those are all to some degree discretionary questions. Once we get beyond that, once it's determined that it meets all the standards, then there's no further hurdle for exclusion. And if it is then excluded, then it is constitutional.
So if I'm hearing you right, any trial error that disadvantages a defendant. Any erroneous ruling that deprives a defendant of some evidence he wanted to offer would amount to a constitutional magnitude violation. Is that right?
Yes, if it's in fact an erroneous ruling.
I mean, and that's because of that anything happens at trial then that is disadvantageous to the defendant amounts, you're saying, to a violation of his constitutional right to present a defense, or what, how would you articulate what that constitutional right is?
Well, I wouldn't say anything that's disadvantageous to the defense. I would say any ruling that excludes relevant, reliable, and admissible evidence. And in fact, that's really the approach, and I know, Justice Coates, you dissented from this, but I know that that's the approach the court took in Golub. In Golub, which we talk about in the briefs, the court basically was talking about the exclusion of expert evidence regarding shoe prints, and held that that the evidence was relevant and competent, that it was error to have excluded it, trial error to have excluded it, and having made those determinations, went directly to the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt analysis, the Chapman analysis, and that we think is the right approach. Other cases that have taken that approach, for example, are the two cases we submitted in supplemental authorities, Turning Bear and Holmes from the Eighth Circuit. And what's interesting about Turning Bear and Holmes, much like Melendez, in fact, from this court, is that they cite Valenzuela Bernal for the favorable and material standard, and then go on to say that because the evidence was relevant, the constitutional right to present a defense was denied. So this is not, I think, this is something that, an approach that's been used in this court's cases. It's an approach that's been used in other circuits. And even in Melendez itself, the court was part of that set of cases that cited Valenzuela Bernal for material and favorable, but then went on to say the reason this was a violation is because the evidence would have materially assisted the defense.
I understand where you're drawing the line then, but just for my benefit, in the event we were to find that this actually should apply a harmless error standard, I assume you'd argue that the evidence was also harmless, or would you argue that? Is your argument dependent upon us finding, is finding your way dependent upon us agreeing that the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt?
Not at all. In regards to the particulars of Mr. Krutzinger's case, apart from all the abstract analysis, in our opinion, this evidence that was excluded was so crucial, so central to the case, that it barely matters what standard you put. That under ordinary harmless error standard, under the creation of a new reasonable doubt standard, under any standard, this evidence was so central because the sole question, both the prosecution and the defense stated this in their closing arguments, the sole question at trial was, can you believe SM? That was the only question. And so when you talk about evidence that would cast into doubt the entire context of her story, when you talk about evidence that would supply her with a powerful motive for having fabricated a story, I think it's impossible to say that this was harmless really under any standard. And so that's really our request to the court, ultimately, is that whatever standard is applied, that nonetheless they should be reversed. We think obviously it's a much easier call to make under a more lenient standard, but I think under any standard, the Court of Appeals was incorrect. Your Honor, if I might, I guess there's just one other issue I'd like to address very briefly, and then I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal if there was no further questions. And that has to do with the Confrontation Clause. There was some back and forth about the Confrontation Clause in the briefs, and so I just wanted to clarify that very briefly. The Confrontation Clause is one of the three constitutional rights that gives rise to the right to present a defense under the relevant Supreme Court law. And so exclusion of this evidence, we think, is both. It is two violations at the same time. It is a violation of the right to present a defense and a violation of the right to confrontation. And the reason it's a violation of the right to confrontation is because it this evidence in its entirety was impeachment evidence. And so we think that really it has to clear both hurdles in order for there to be no error found. It has to be found that the court was correct under both the Confrontation Clause test and under the right to present a defense test. And so I wanted to clarify that because I think we were not as clear as we might have been in the briefs on that issue. And if there's no further questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Pete, please, the court. Reggie Diazby, registration 360043, representing the people in this case. This court is being asked to hold that any erroneous exclusion of defense evidence, regardless of how important or unimportant that evidence is, amounts to a constitutional error and violation because it affects the defendant's right to present a defense and because it possibly might have affected the outcome of the trial. Such a per se rule, which constitutionalizes every evidentially ruling an error, not only defies common sense, but it has been specifically rejected both in Colorado and the federal level. The case law in Colorado and in federal jurisdictions requires a defendant in such a circumstance to establish that the constitutional materiality as opposed to evidentiary materiality of the excluded evidence. In the most recent case addressing the general proposition that is being made here, Kreider decided last June, this court unanimously agreed that prosecutorial misconduct in closing argument should be reviewed under the general, not the constitutional, harmless error standard. And in this context, this court stated, quote, although virtually any trial error capable of prejudicing a criminal defendant could in some sense be characterized as affecting his right to a fair trial, neither this court nor the Supreme Court has ever designated broad categories of error as error of constitutional magnitude. Now, the defendant here is asking this court to carve out an exception to that general principle that was adopted and announced in Kreider. More specifically, in Melendez, this court dealt with the exclusion of defense witness testimony, not deportation of government witnesses, and relied on Valenzuela Bernal to hold that constitutional materiality is required, that the defendant is required to establish that the excluded evidence was both material and favorable. And by the way, this was not the first case in Colorado that adopted Valenzuela Bernal's holding. In Chastain, the court also referred to Valenzuela Bernal and adopted the general position, although that case dealt with compulsory process. The court concluded that the same materiality standard is applied in a due process analysis. The federal cases that I have cited in the answer brief on pages 14 and 15 all support the position that constitutional materiality is required, not only in the context of access to evidence or Brady line of cases, but also in the exclusion of evidence by the trial court. There is no distinction made in those cases between the two settings. So the only question really is whether the formulation of the constitutional materiality test adopted in Krutzinger 1 was correct or not.
Excuse me, could you just, how do you deal with Golub? How do you deal with Golub?
I think the Golub case, although the specific holding did not address the question of constitutional materiality, but the discussion of the evidence itself indicated that the court was well aware, and because there was no dispute in that case, that the issue dealt with vital, important evidence, the expert testimony, which dealt with the footprint as the central piece of evidence against the defendant. So the language of Golo, in terms of the discussion of the evidence, shows clearly that evidence was material and favorable. The test adopted.
Could I ask one more question?
Yes.
Just while you're sort of in this area and you're talking about where we've applied the test, you relied on Melendez. Melendez, remind me, the evidence is excluded because of a sequestration violation?
Yes.
And do you see there as being any difference between excluding for failure to comply with the rules of evidence in a trial and excluding for some kind of a violation or irregularity outside the trial process in terms of application of a materiality standard?
Your Honor, I don't believe that in itself distinguishes the two cases, because the effect is the deprivation of the defendant to present the defense witness testimony in both cases. And the critical factor is that whether the excluded evidence somehow affected the outcome of the trial, whether it was based on improper evidentiary ruling or the situation in Melendez, the court's conclusion that the witness had violated sequestration order, I don't think that makes any difference in terms of the issue in that case. Here, I'd like to point out that the Bagley case summarizes the constitutional materiality test that the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, had earlier adopted in Akers and Valenzuela-Bernal by combining the two situations that were distinguished in Akers and making them into one situation, and then applying the Strickland test. It is important to keep in mind that the Strickland test focuses on reasonable probability that the error, which in that case, of course, is the ineffectiveness of counsel, would have affected the result of the proceeding. And the reasonable probability standard is critical, because today Mr. Zweifel accepted that Bagley adopted reasonable probability, whereas in the opening brief and in the reply brief, Mr. Neuwirth insisted that that case required only possibility, reducing the standard required from the defendant. And Kyles is very specific on this issue, saying that the touchstone of Bagley is the reasonable probability of a different result.
Oh, is that the standard that was used in Kretzinger 1 and 2?
In Kretzinger 1, the court didn't use that language, Your Honor, but as I have argued in my answer brief, the Strickland standard itself incorporates a reasonable doubt that did not exist in its test. So although the language may be different in cases, and this is...
I thought that in Kyle's, Justice Souter, one of those four reasons that he articulated,
yes,
said that's not the case precisely. I could get it.
I'm sorry, what is not the case?
That what you just said is not the way to interpret the test, the constitutional test.
I'm not exactly sure what Your Honor is referring
to. Okay, I'll get it for you. Go ahead, Dorg. I don't mean to.
So it is important to acknowledge that Bagley requires a reasonable probability of a different result. And the reasonable probability of a different result, again, incorporates in itself that there is a reasonable doubt that did not exist before. This is the test that in Richmond, the 10th Circuit Court adopted, and Kretzinger 1 relied on that case and Valenzuela Bernal in stating the case, stating the test the way that it did and applying it based on a new reasonable doubt that did not exist.
Well, if we disagree a little bit with that last statement and say that Kretzinger 1, Kretzinger 2, and trial court didn't use the reasonable probability standard in Kiles, let's assume that for a second. What do you think we should do in this case?
If the court did not use...
Yes. If the court actually articulated an incorrect standard and applied it, what does it make a difference, or what should we do?
Well, I would suggest that we look at what the court did, not only the specific language the court used, because the court started with saying that if there is, a reasonable probability or something to that effect, that the error, the exclusion of the evidence, affected the outcome of the trial. And I would argue that that itself, which is something that the court tried to explain by saying that a new reasonable doubt, but the bottom line is that did the exclusion of the evidence affect the outcome of the trial? And in that sense, I don't think there's any ground to argue that the court did not apply that test.
Well, Judge, let me just read you what the trial judge said, and you tell us how we should take a look at this.
I'm sorry, what is...
Let me read to you what the trial judge said. He said, materiality means whether this evidence could have created a reasonable doubt that did not exist without that evidence. And he cites both Kretzinger cases. Let's assume that we don't agree with that articulation of that standard. Are you saying that that doesn't matter? Is that your position?
It is my position that it is the same test.
And if we don't agree with that, then what should we do?
If this court concludes that the test that was applied is incorrect,
yes,
then obviously the test, it has to remand the case for applying the correct test. But I believe if we focus on what was done both in Kretzinger, in the trial court on remand and also in Kretzinger 2, the focus was on the reasonable probability that the excluded evidence affected the outcome of the case. So the language may be different, maybe not precise enough that, to the extent that this court would like, but the substance of the test is proper, and it is what was adopted in this by this court in Melendez.
Do you mind if I switch the nature of this conversation? Why isn't this harmless error just in any event?
Why is this or is
it? Is this not harmless error in any
because
event?
Because the excluded evidence, Your Honor, was purely cumulative.
Well, this is the only doctor, the only expert who had been talking with this child.
But he was not endorsed as an expert witness. The only significance of this evidence, Your Honor, is the statements given to her by the victim. He is not presented as an expert witness.
Well, it doesn't really matter whether it's an expert or not. It was a witness who directly contradicted or at least could establish some contradictions as to the child's story, the dates, that kind of thing. And also, I think at some point, didn't the child say that she was just almost sure or something along those lines? Not sure. She suggested some lack of certainty.
Your Honor, everything that the doctor's note contained was brought into evidence, was not admitted into evidence, was brought to the attention of the jury during the cross-examination of the victim. So
at some point the victim was asked, didn't you tell the doctor that you were only almost sure or not sure?
Yes.
I mean, the record would support everything that the doctor would have testified to, the child was cross-examined about?
I can't, Your Honor, say that everything, but the key points that the defense raised in the offer of proof that was made when the evidence was excluded and even on appeal, those key points were brought to the attention of the jury. The victim was specifically impeached on those issues. For example, and
How old was the child when she testified?
I believe
12 or 13 and through there. I don't know.
I'm not sure at this point, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'd like to point out
but
that...
I just want to ask you one more question, and you can answer, of course. But her conversation with the doctor took place when she was significantly younger and over a course of years. Or could you tell me if that's wrong?
The time of the trial.
She was talking historically about what she was able to remember when I was in second grade, when I was in third grade, when I was in fourth grade.
I'm not sure Your Honor was referring to the conversation.
Well, what I'm concerned about, let me ask you it this way, is at least thinking about this, it would seem to me that there is that the failure to admit this testimony is potentially not harmless. It was something which was very much to the detriment of the defendant. Why is that not true? And so far you've said it's because it's cumulative. Is that your only reason for why this is not true?
Not the only reason.
What is your other reason, please?
Because the issues raised in that go to, as the Court of Appeals in Kratzinger 2 pointed out, those issues do not go to the heart of the issue of whether the victim was abused or not, but they go to some marginal issues such as for example, the starting date.
Well, doesn't it go to the heart of the issue of whether she's telling the truth or not?
As I pointed out, Your Honor, the issue of credibility of the victim was attacked from the very beginning of the case. She was accused of being a liar, not only with respect to the sexual assault allegations, but to with respect to turning in homework. So all those cases that presumably established, and this is again pointed out by the Kratzinger 2 Court of Appeals decision, that every instance of lack of credibility was brought to the attention of the jury. But despite all those charges, and despite the fact that from the very beginning, she was attacked as being a habitual liar, the jury decided that found enough proof to convict the defendant.
Who testified that the child might have had a motive to testify against the defendant because she wished to alienate that relationship or she felt her mother didn't love her, those kinds of things?
Nobody testified, but she was impeached on the whole notion of the relationship between her and the mother.
But what about her and her wanting perhaps alienate the relationship between the mother and the defendant?
It was clear from her testimony that she did not like the defendant. So it was clear before the jury that this child did not have a good relationship with the defendant and had some issues with her mother as well. So those issues were used to impeach the victim in this case. And as I pointed out in the answer brief, the testimony by Dr. Howard, first of all, it would have been limited to her notes because she didn't have any independent recollection of what was said. So everything would have been summarized in the notes. And the notes themselves do not even, that evidence itself is not necessarily favorable to the defendant because for example, if the ending of the sexual assault period is critical, the victim here consistently stated that she was abused until the sixth grade. The only evidence that would have contradicted that is one of the notes on the first session of Dr. Howard. Dr. Howard's own notes on the following session, or maybe two sessions after that, a total of four sessions, her own notes indicate that she said sixth grade. This inconsistency between the notes would have proved that the victim was correct and consistent in all her statements that it was the sixth grade. And it would undermine any impeachment value of Dr. Howard's testimony. So not only it was impeachment evidence, but it was not favorable because it on some issues, did not contradict what SM, the victim, has said. Unless this court has any questions, I would ask this court to affirm Court of Appeals judgment. Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to, if I may, get back to some of perhaps the factual matters that were raised by Justice Rice. SM was 16 years old when she testified. The evidence in this case that was in Dr. Howard's notes and in Dr. Howard's testimony was, in fact, not cumulative. In fact, it was not before the jury.
Could you just repeat that? I didn't hear what you said.
I'm sorry. I apologize, Judge. The evidence in Dr. Howard's notes was not cumulative and was, in fact, not before the jury, with a couple of exceptions. The start date of the alleged abuse was not before the jury in any manner. The end date of the alleged abuse, fourth grade versus sixth grade, it was an attempted impeachment of SM. She denied it. She said, I've always said it was sixth grade. And having said that, because Dr. Howard couldn't testify, the impeachment was never completed and it was, in fact, not before the jury. The relationship between her and her mother. There was some evidence that she had a rocky relationship with her mother, but what Dr. Howard's notes and Dr. Howard had to say that wasn't before the jury was that after SM made the allegation, she reported that her relationship with her mother improved, that she had in fact obtained the goal that she was seeking. Her poor memory of events in elementary school was not before the jury. The contradiction of Dr. Howard, between Dr. Howard and herself, concerning the reporting requirements, SM saying that Dr. Howard said she wouldn't have to report if there was no identification of the perpetrator. Dr. Howard denied that. That was not before the jury. None of that was before the jury. So to say that it's cumulative is simply, I think, incorrect.
Well, help me understand what the trial judge found. I thought the trial judge found that Dr. Howard had no independent recollection of this, so she was testifying from her notes solely, and that her notes were in evidence, or were used, maybe not in evidence, but were used to cross-examine the victim at the first trial, or the original trial.
The notes, in fact, were not in evidence. The notes were tendered as part of the offer of proof, but they were not before the jury. The only time the notes were used was the attempted impeachment of SM regarding the fourth grade versus sixth grade contradiction. And so the notes themselves never became before the jury. They were referenced.
But the defendants had the notes, right?
Yes.
And it was the trial court correct that Dr. Howard could not testify beyond her notes, that she had no independent recollection of this child and these counseling sessions?
I believe she did have some independent recollection, but I agree that she did testify that she testified that, first of all, if she had been able to testify at the time of trial, it was likely that she would have had a better independent recollection.
What was the time difference between the
between
remand?
The trial and and the remand hearing? I'm sorry, Judge. I just don't think that.
Well, am I wrong? Didn't the trial judge find that, and as part of his reasoning as to why this was not reversible error, that she would not have added anything to the what was ever in her notes?
Yes, and the trial judge was incorrect in stating that the notes were before the jury. The notes were referenced in the sense of the defense counsel saying, isn't it true that you told Dr. Howard such and such and she denied it? That's it.
Well, but the defense could make whatever use it wanted to of those notes, presumably, right?
Well, the notes were not admissible.
Well, but it could have used it more as part of the cross-examination. Would they use part of it? Am I misunderstanding what you said?
Yes, the defense could have. However, it's not, they're not required to.
Was there any attempt to use those notes to show a prior consistent statement, for example?
I don't believe there was.
That would have been possible. If there'd been an attempt to impeach with a prior inconsistent, you could have gone with a prior consistent, couldn't you?
I think it would have if it met the requirements of Rule 801 or Evans. I think certainly a prior consistent statement could have been introduced at that point. But, you know, that's, I think, at this point, all hypothetical, because that's not a question we've examined, to what extent under Evans, Rule 801, under Ely, the extent of the prior consistent statements. And so I'm not sure, frankly, how far the prosecution could have gone with that. And in answer to your question, Justice Bender, my co-counsel has helpfully informed me that the trial was August 2003, and the remand hearing was December 2005. So it was a little over 2 years that had passed.
And the counseling sessions were in 2002, I think. Is that right?
I believe that's correct. They were when she was in high school, and it was the counseling sessions took place while she was supposedly having these conversations with her mother, in which she was almost sure about being abused and so on. So I think that's right. And by the way, the almost sure stuff, that was not brought up in trial, and so that also is something that was in the notes that simply wasn't before the jury. I'd like to just briefly go back to another point that Mr. Yazdi discussed. I'm afraid I may not have been as clear as I wanted to be about the Bagley standard. The way this works, our argument is that Bagley states that that prejudice occurs where an evidence is material, where there's a reasonable probability of a different result. True. But then it goes on to define reasonable probability as a probability that undermines confidence in the outcome. In Kyle's, the court then goes on to say that undermining confidence in the outcome is not, in fact, not a probability standard. It's, in fact, entirely different, and not a, there's no requirement that the defendant prove that the outcome of the trial would have been different. And so they specifically reject the would have been different standard. And in fact, they do at times refer to it as a possibility standard. And so you can't take the term reasonable probability of Bagley out of context, I think, and I did simply by mentioning in my first argument. But if you follow it all the way through, both through the undermined confidence and how the term undermined confidence is then explicated in Kyle's, you end up at basically a reasonable probability standard, a standard in which the court must be confident that the jury verdict would have been unaffected. And I think that is really the farthest reach of what a materiality requirement could be, if there is a materiality requirement here. It can't be any greater than that's in Kyle's. And so even if we're incorrect that there is no materiality standard, then I think it has to be not the creation of a new reasonable doubt, but rather the undermined confidence standard. The creation of a new reasonable doubt is an outcome determinative test, and they state so in Richmond. They state, quote, it's an outcome-driven test, and that's what was specifically rejected in Kyle's. The court need not conclude that there would have been a different result in its own judgment, but simply that a jury could have reached a different result and that its confidence in the verdict is undermined. And if there are no further questions, I thank the court for its attention. We would ask to reverse the court of appeals.
Thank you. On behalf of the court, I want to thank counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted.